I think all of us can agree that getting older means changes are in store. While I may look like I'm in my 20s, you guys know the truth and my body is changing and I'm always learning what it wants. Whether you're in your early 20s and experiencing changes in your menstrual cycle, or your age is a little bit higher and you're nearing perimenopause or menopause, we should be talking about it. There shouldn't be any shame in looking for ways to support our body through changes and help ourselves through difficult times. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it. It's perfect for symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Things like hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, and occasional bloating and gas. And the biggest benefit? Women say, feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in Hormone Harmony reviews. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com just by using the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today. As I've gotten older, it's become more and more important to me that I support my immune system and digestion. I'm always looking for a supplement that's not only good for my body, but tastes good too. That's where Equilibria Daily Nutrigreens comes in. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. Daily Nutrigreens contain an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and vegetables. These greens are great because they're the quickest way to fill in your daily nutritional gaps, and it tastes good. Equilibria makes it easy to meet your nutritional goals. You can subscribe so you don't have to worry about running out, and you get 25% off each month. Head to myeq.com and use code RAIN for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutrigreens and much more. That's myeq.com and use code RAIN at checkout for 15% off site-wide today.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. Starting in March 1983 and through June 1993, someone was killing young black women and girls in North Portland. The victims weren't acknowledged with much more than a blip in the paper. The killer wasn't making the headlines as bombastic Ted Bundy was. He wasn't prolific enough to warrant a task force like Gary Ridgway. He was a mentally ill man with an extensive criminal history, unmanageable addictions, and no memory of what he may have done. Today's story isn't about that man, though. It's about his four confirmed victims and his possible other victims. Next week, I'll be sharing the story of the subsequent arrest, charges, and jail time given to the man police felt could have been responsible for up to 25 murders, and how once he was found guilty, his sentence left the family members of victims appalled. Today's story came to me by accident. I was researching another case on newspapers.com, and in a neighboring article, I saw a name and read a story I had never heard of. When I read that there had been a man who was allegedly responsible for murdering sex workers and trafficked girls for a decade, I was shocked to have never known of him. In a way, the timing of the story seems like kismet. The story of today's victims and their treatment is eerily similar to that of Kristen Smith, Ashley Real, Charity Perry, Joanna Speaks, and Bridget Webster, all victims from the last 2 years, some of which who have been connected to the same alleged killer. With the recent announcement of charges against alleged serial killer Jesse Calhoun, it seemed like a good time to share the story, to explore how far we've come in our coverage and care for these girls, and how far there is to go. For a refresher on the charges against Calhoun, check out last month's update episode. And in our forthcoming update, we will be discussing his recent first day in court. On March 24, 1983, at the very bottom of the 21st page of the Oregonian, a small headline read, "Body found near North Portland Park." Overlook Park is right off the I-5 and North Interstate Highway. Its name is appropriate, as the park does indeed overlook Portland. There are views of the expansive railroad yards, the 405 Bridge, Big Pink, and the rest of the beautiful city. It was from 20 feet below Overlook Park and around 5 p.m. on March 23, 1983, that a call was made to the Portland police. That day, the clouds were covering the sky like a gray blanket, and the temp was a balmy 53. A man who had been enjoying a typical early spring day in Portland spotted something in the bushes. Approaching the foliage, he noticed that it was a woman's hand jutting out. The hand was showing signs of decomposition, so he made his way to the closest phone and rang for help. Once police arrived, they found a woman's body in the bush, partially dressed and perched upon the steep hillside. Carefully removing her from the hill, she was brought in for examination, where her death was ruled a homicide. It was decided that due to the decomposition and discoloration, she had been dead for about a week. At that time, the autopsy confirmed that she had been sexually abused before her death, but it could not determine a cause of death. Eventually, it would be decided she had died from asphyxiation via strangulation. 2 days after the body had been found, a positive identification was made. The woman was 23-year-old Essie Carey Jackson. On March 30th, her family held a funeral service at the St. Andrew Catholic Church. There isn't much information publicly available about Essie. Her parents were older and both from the South. Her father had been drafted in World War II. Based only on what my non-professional ancestry research found, I would guess, based on her parents' ages and her brother being 17 years older, that she was, like my own mother, an uninvited guest to the party, aka possibly a surprise or unexpected pregnancy. In her 1976 yearbook photo from Jackson High School, which became Jackson Middle School in 1982, Essie exudes joy. Her hair is curly and styled into a spectacularly tall afro. Though the picture is in black and white, you can almost see the bright colors in the plaid of her wide-collared blouse covering part of a puka-shell necklace. Her huge smile shows off front teeth, which either have a small gap at the bottom or maybe a chip in one of the teeth. Her glasses are groovy, oversized, and she looks like every 17-year-old at the time. She seems happy, but as we know, a photo can only tell so much of a story.
What year is that photo from?
76.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's very 76. 6 years after that photo was taken, Essie would be found dead in the park. A newer photo was offered to the media when she passed, not that anyone printed it at the time. Now in color, her picture appears to be from her government ID. In it, Essie still has an afro, although it's significantly smaller. Her glasses are bigger, less stylish, much more 80s inspired. The biggest difference between the photos isn't Essie's age going from 17 to 23 or from black and white to color. It's the lost smile. Her closed mouth looks like it could be concealing the gap. The sadness in her eyes starkly contrasts her yearbook picture. I had to ask Josh to confirm that the pictures were of the same person. Something had happened in those vulnerable years that led to Essie becoming, as the state would later learn, a victim of sex trafficking. This was the early 80s, so trafficking was not really part of the conversation. One could guess Essie's murder was dismissed as she was deemed to be merely a prostitute. Essie's trafficker did not inform her mother that she was missing for at least 4 days. With so little information available about the victims, I was unable to reach any family members. So I ask if anyone listening knows anyone connected to any of today's cases, if you could please share our information and have them Gmail us, it would be much appreciated. On Saturday, July 9th, 1983, just 4 months after Essie's body was discovered, another call from a passerby was made to police. And I thought I didn't have much information on Essie. Tanya Nanette Harry has even less available to the public. The reporting on her death followed the same pattern as Essie's. As the person who would eventually call the police made their way through West Delta Park near the Columbia River Slough, right by a golf course in North Portland, they saw a body partially submerged in the slough. At 2 p.m., a call was made. Police arrived and quickly determined that this was a homicide case. The discovery of the young, murdered Black woman was put on the 62nd page of the Oregonian, right above an ad for a fishing charter. On Tuesday the 12th, the Oregonian would report the woman's identity had been learned. It was 19-year-old Tanya Nanette Harry. She was listed as unemployed, but it was believed that she, too, was either a sex worker or a trafficking victim or both. Next to Tanya's body was her elastic burgundy belt. It was believed to have been removed from her pants and used as a ligature to strangle her, a means of death the autopsy confirmed. Although the belt might not have caused her death, as it was broken into multiple pieces, it was possible someone may have started strangling her with the belt, but because it was so flimsy, they moved on to another tool or their own hands. Her autopsy showed she, too, had been sexually abused before her death, had possible involvement of drug toxicity as there were fresh needle marks in her arm, and she had a ligature mark across her neck and lacerations on her back. The belt was gathered along with all other evidence. Sadly, all of my digging online only led me to learn that Tanya was buried at the Willamette National Cemetery and her father was Sergeant First Class Willie J. Harry. Every other result you get when searching for information about her is when she's listed along with the other victims as quick blurbs when discussing the killer. It would only be 2 months until another body was discovered. A house on Northeast Going Street in Portland had been placed on the market by the Department of Veterans Affairs. I would assume this was related to a home that had been purchased utilizing a VA loan, which went into foreclosure, so it was then picked up by the DVA. When a house is being sold by the DVA, Veteran Affairs people have access to the property so they can show the home to potential buyers. Something awful happened between the listing on September 2nd and a showing on the 22nd. The day a prospective buyer went through the home. When they, the interested party, and the DVA representative got to a bedroom on the second floor, they found the badly decomposed, partially undressed body of a young black woman with a window rope cord around her neck and superficial cuts to her wrist. She had laid on the floor in the summer temperatures of low 70s for an unknown amount of time. This had led to such bad decomposition, the medical examiner could not confirm how long she had been dead.
Imagine how startling that would be.
Going you think through you're a just house, looking through a house?
I can't even fathom.
And it's not we're the police going through a dilapidated property.
No, this is for sale.
This is to sell you the home.
That's insane. That first of all, that the person didn't do a walkthrough before inviting the people in.
Right, just to make sure everything was in place. Well, they don't do walkthroughs like I used to. They didn't say what ended up happening because at that point, do you still sell it? Is it now
a reduced price? Well, it's a crime scene, I would imagine.
Do they tear it down? I'm not sure what became of the home, but...
Boy, oh boy.
That would stay with you.
What a story.
I think that would stay with you just... Anytime you went to a second floor and were going to a room.
Anytime I go look at a house, I'm like, can you please make sure you do a walkthrough before I show up?
Quick body check.
Yeah.
Was the body found with the ligature still around the neck?
From my understanding, yes.
A strong cord, those blinds, like a blind pull, right? To like pull your mini blinds.
Yeah. So it's whatever was on the window. And it didn't say how big the window was or how long that would have been. So I can only imagine how... grisly that would have been. It's not like, oh, she was just laying in the floor. I'm sure that
it was a violent death.
I imagine
death.
That scene was just gnarly to walk in on.
Oof. Absolutely. What the autopsy could show was that the girl had been strangled. What could not be determined was if she had been brought into the house and then strangled, or if she had been murdered at another location and left in the home after the fact. However, the cord came from the window in that room, so I think it'd be safe to say she was killed at the scene. Mm-hmm. Like the other victims, she was also sexually abused prior to being murdered.
That's interesting. So this person likely knew the house was unoccupied and took her in there or lured her there, or maybe she was there for work?
I think it was known in the neighborhood as being available.
People use that house a lot.
Yes, my understanding, and I'll talk about it a little bit more, is just why they ended up there, but it sounds like in the neighborhood, they knew that that was an empty house.
I see.
Lying near the body were two cigarette butts and two struck matches, all of which were collected by investigators. Fingerprints were lifted from a cabinet door and a window in the room. Lying against that door, which had been removed from the hinges, was a bloody sock, which would later be proved to be the property of the deceased. Eventually, the victim was identified. Her name was Angela Anderson, and she was just 14 years old.
Oh.
Being that she was so young, and even at that age, being dismissed as a prostitute, there is nothing about Angela online. I've tried to find a way to contact her sister, Dondra Lawson, who was very vocal at the trial, which I'll get to, but I've had no luck. While I love findagrave.com as a resource, it is publicly edited like Wikipedia, so I can't confirm everything written on a person's page. That being said, there is a claim in her bio that Angela had been in the foster care system. I reached out to DHS for confirmation, but I've yet to hear back from them, which is totally understandable given their caseloads and incredibly difficult job. Whatever Angela's story was, a path in her life led to her being trafficked, which, if she had been in the foster system, wouldn't have been shocking. From Emily Seelig's contribution to the Children's Legal Rights Journal. It was estimated in 2018 that 100,000 minors were trafficked in the U.S. I can only imagine that that number was not only much lower than the actual number, but it has risen over the last 6 years. Foster children face a much higher rate of victimization, which is believed to be due to being already marginalized. Many foster kids are runaways, houseless, and are often members of the LGBTQIA2S+ community. I wasn't aware until this research that the foster care system has the horrible nickname of pipeline to prostitution, which Jesus. I had never heard. Because older children struggle to get fostered or adopted, about a quarter of kids in the system are over 14 years old, their age adds to their vulnerability. Once a child turns 18, they are usually asked to leave the residence as the state is no longer financially supporting them. Foster parents do have a choice in that, but for many, they don't have the resources to care for the children without the state support, or they need to make room for another kid that will come with a check. I don't say that to speak disparagingly of foster parents. Foster parents are incredible heroes that deserve a lot more than what they're given for the work that comes with welcoming a child into their home. However, I've far too often experienced the paycheck parents who treat the monetary component as a key decider when it comes to keeping a child. So when a foster kid is let out into the world at 18 and they're already at a societal, financial, and support system disadvantage, which can make getting a job or housing difficult, not having either can make the newly legal adults easy targets for predators whose offers of housing, money, or a job can be hard to refuse. In 2016, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children spoke to 18,500 runaway youths. Of those, one out of six, or 16%, reported being victims of sex trafficking. Of that 16%, 86%, or 2,516 of those children, had been under the protection of social services or foster care when they were trafficked.
You've unlocked some memories for me today.
Okay.
I had a babysitter growing up that was typically one for low-income families.
Mm-hmm.
So she took a lot of kids that other parents maybe couldn't afford other daycares
right.
in the area. And the family always had a lot of foster kids. And I stayed over a lot because my mom was a bartender. So up until age 8, I stayed the night with people on the nights she worked. And I remember just like a revolving door of foster kids. And she always took teens, which was really great of them. But they were also an awful family. So I don't want to say they were too great because they were definitely abusive. But I remember one particular girl. She was 2 or 3 years older than me. And her stories were, at the time, unbelievable to me. I didn't think they were real. And now looking back, I'm like, wow.
Of just being trafficked?
Sexual abuse and all of the homes she had and just horrible story. And I didn't really, I grasped what it was just because we had HBO. So obviously I grasped what like sexual activity was, but I thought she was making up tall tales.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got older, I realized what the foster care system is like for some of these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about that. Every once in a while, you hear one of these stories, and I'm like, oh, God, I wonder what happened to her. And it's just horrible. But I think the lack of support as they age out of the system and getting jobs and placements where they can be successful is few and far between. And you're really reliant on the good foster families. There are some out there.
There are great foster families.
But they also don't have the means to like put these kids through college always, but maybe they have the education to help them get scholarships and whatnot. But if you don't have anyone helping you through that, what are you going to do? You're going to get easy money.
Yeah.
Because you want to live.
I've encountered families that are blatant about it. They're like, oh, no, we need a check. We've got to get a kid with a check kind of a thing. Like, it's very clear that that's what they're doing. But in all fairness, even if a family, if that's not their drive and they want to keep the child in their home, even when they turn 18, have you been to the grocery store lately? Could you imagine paying for an 18-year-old for what they need to eat.
Imagine places like Hawaii or Alaska.
Yeah. And then let alone your own family that you're trying to support. And it's not that you don't want to support this kid, but now you've lost this check that was at least covering some of the expenses. Mm-hmm. That takes a really kind soul and a really someone with the means to do that.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't have those means.
Yeah.
Some say, I think it's pretty common knowledge that some people are drawn to having foster kids because of the money.
Right.
Even if they are great people, they're like, well, yeah, it's, you know, they're supplementing an income in our household so I can stay home with my kids.
Of course, there should be money involved because you are caring for this child.
Sure.
They need clothes. They need food. They need housing. They need all
those
things.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's a bad thing.
Yeah, no, not at all. But there's just got to be a better way to screen the people and to properly financially support the families. And like you said, just like someone getting out of jail, there's got to be something.
Transition.
Yes. Something in place to say, hey, if you were a foster kid. And I know there are resources like that, but.
Yeah, but
something more.
It's like how
concrete.
Common are they and how many states have
how accessible.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I was in foster care for just a few months when I was a baby before I was adopted, apparently by just the greatest couple ever. I don't know their name or anything, but a couple summers ago, I talked to a friend of mine who also grew up in foster care for the first 6 or 7 years of their life. And they were abused, assaulted, raped for years. And I believe they were in the system with their sibling. And I don't know if anything happened to the sibling, but I know maybe my friend took like the brunt of the abuse. I think so. Because the sibling was kind of, their health was not great. Anyways. Yeah, I don't know. I just, that's that system. It had an effect on my life. It had an effect on their life. And that friend had an effect on my life because that abuse came to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just never really thought about it before.
It's a cycle.
That wave. Yeah, just it passed through me. It affected me as well.
You were a recipient of that person's abuse, but that abuse was really from that family. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
What's crazy to think, if one thing was different, maybe that never would have happened.
Yep.
You know, it really is a cycle, and it's so unfortunate.
Yeah, I think there was just no oversight for the people that they were housed with.
Yeah.
And that's what's so hard. I know there are parents that need their kids taken away. I get that.
Right.
But sometimes these situations with a little bit of support, maybe they wouldn't need to be taken away. And I know that's
right.
If somebody came and said, I'm taking your child and putting them in foster care, the risk of their safety, oh God, it increases so much by being in that situation.
I don't think that's controversial to say, because I've seen that where you're, yes, I'm going to call DHS. I'm a mandatory reporter and that's getting reported, but that kid doesn't need to be taken out of that.
Especially
home.
If it's because like they were left home alone at, say, age 8 versus 13 or something.
Right. How can we get them child care support?
Right. It's just so horrible because of all, just in this room, the people we know who have been sexually abused or physically abused. Or mentally abused. My babysitter was horrific.
Right.
I don't want to get into it, but I mean, I cannot eat certain foods because of her. I have flashbacks to seeing things like it really affected everyone, even though I wasn't a recipient of her abuse in the same way.
Yeah,
other
but
kids
secondary
were.
Abuse and secondary trauma is absolutely a thing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Witnessing that or not being able to change it. And
it's just got such a the foster
guilt,
care
probably.
System has such a stigma, and so much of it is accurate and it really needs to be addressed.
Well, and what kills me too is how the money is used, because I don't know if you guys know this, when they can't place a kid. So I had a student who was, we made a call and they were taken from the home because there was some, it was called for, but they didn't have a placement. And literally the child goes and stays in a hotel with the DHS person.
Oh my God.
Every type of job has heroes and villains. And there are a lot of heroes in DHS and a lot of heroes in child support. But if you know that that's what that system is set up for, and you have an inclination to know that you could be in a hotel room with a child that has no one to talk to, like, that made me sick. I didn't judge the person that was covering them. I was thankful that this child was taken out of their home. But to think of how many kids...
They're the most vulnerable.
Yeah. So
I can't even... And they're not paid well. So
no.
Why else would you want to get in, you know? Like, why would you want to get into that unless you were a good person or a bad person?
Kudos to all of the good workers and the good families and the ones that are really trying to make a difference
and change.
And change it, because it needs a lot of change. The True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival is just around the corner. We'll be at the Denver Marriott Westminster July 12th through 14th, manning our booth, giving out stickers, selling merch, and facilitating a session on Sunday morning. There's still plenty of time to get tickets, and you can use our code RAIN15 to get 15% off your purchase. The True Crime Paranormal Podcast Festival is a great opportunity to connect with your favorite podcasts, those impacted by the cases we discuss, and other true crime fans and creators. We had a blast last year, and we cannot wait for this year. We think you will have a great time, too, so join us. You can get your tickets at truecrimepodcastfestival.com, and remember to use the code RAIN15 at checkout for 15% off. Another study found 60% of underage people arrested for prostitution in Los Angeles had come from foster care. In Connecticut, a survey of their own found 86 out of 88 trafficked children had at some point been involved with the child welfare system. The only photo of Angela Anderson publicly available is a simple one. The little bit of background you can see appears to be a very late 70s, early 80s home, tan walls, brown furniture. In her cream t-shirt, Angela's smile is big, even if it looks slightly restrained. The lighting makes it hard to tell if she has a small afro or longer hair over her shoulder. She's beautiful, full of potential, and clearly just a child. A mile and a half away from the house on Northeast Going Street where Angela's body was found, and 3.5 years later, another body was discovered lying in some grass in an empty lot beneath a pedestrian overpass near the intersection of Northeast Going Court and North Concord Avenue. It was March 1987 when that body was discovered. There was such little coverage of the mystery woman's death, I can't even confirm the exact date. Wiki says it was the 18th. Her service was held around the 25th, so I would say it was in that window of time. She was affiliated with sex work, most likely due to trafficking. She was strangled, dumped, discovered, and it was called in. Upon arrival, officers found a woman's body who had been strangled with a scarf, which was then wrapped around her head. Her upper body was wrapped in plastic wrap or a plastic sheet, which made it appear she may have been dragged to that location. An autopsy repeated the same pattern as with the other victims. I don't know if they could determine the time of her death or how long she had been in the elements. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled. As for evidence, the tissue from under her fingernails was collected. It was learned the victim was another young Black woman, 29-year-old Latonja Watts. Literally, the only information I could find surrounding her life was that her funeral was held at Van and Van, which was not only the first African-American funeral home in Oregon, but it was home to Mrs. Roberta Van, the first licensed female mortician in Oregon.
Wow, cool.
Those are some fun facts, but they don't help us to get to know Latonja. Even though the deaths of the Black female sex workers around North Portland were now years apart, there was clearly a pattern. But did the authorities recognize it? There was another pattern of murders taking place at this time. Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, was active in the Pacific Northwest, and in the early 80s, there were 24 deaths officials were looking at possibly being connected to the Green River Killer and to each other. What was known about the Green River Killer in 1984 was that he targeted young women and girls from 14 to 31 years old. He wasn't focused on a particular race, just that his victims were involved in the sex trade. So when Essie, Latonja, and Angela wound up murdered in similar fashions, their cases were handed off to the Green River Task Force. Portland police also included the murders of Vicki L. Williams, Trina D. Hunter, and Karen Thomas, all of whom were also young Black women with possible ties to sex work. Vicki L. Williams was a 19-year-old mother to her baby Richard when her body was discovered on April 23, 1984. It was 6:30 p.m. when two friends were walking in the parking lot behind an apartment complex in the Sullivan's Gulch neighborhood. This is a neighborhood surrounding what used to be the bustling mall Lloyd Center. Though it is not considered technically North Portland, the Lloyd Center area does butt up to North Portland, so it would only be about 3 miles to get from the mall to the Going Street murder locations. Much like the other cases, Vicky's body was beneath some branches and lying partially down an embankment created by the construction of the future light rail train system. She was also rumored to be involved in sex work. Unlike the other cases, Vicky's cause of death was abdominal stab wounds, not drowning or strangulation. A funeral was held for the teenaged mother on May 9th at the Open Door House of Prayer. Vicky had been living in Portland since 1967 after her family moved from Kansas City, Missouri when she was 3 years old. The last reported sighting of Vicky had been on March 18th, over a month before her body was found, near the 2400 block of MLK, or for those more familiar with North Portland, it was a block from what is now the Wonder Ballroom. At that time, she was wearing a red blouse, dark pants with pinstripes, white tennis shoes, and a dark purple floor-length raincoat. Vicky's case is still open and is being handled by Portland's cold case team. It appears her death was not connected to the Green River Killer or whoever was killing the other women in town. If you have any information about the stabbing murder of 19-year-old Vicky Williams on or around April 23, 1984, or you have any information about her whereabouts from March 18th until her death, you are asked to contact the cold case unit directly at 503-823-0400. Or to remain anonymous, witnesses can provide information through Crime Stoppers of Oregon, who is offering a $2,500 reward for information that leads to an arrest. You can submit tips at crimestoppersoforegon.com or call 503-823-4357. Trina Deanne Hunter's case is a legit mystery. I cannot find a single document or report as to if her case is active, cold, solved. The most recent mention of her case is from the Columbian in June of 2014. It was unsolved at that time, but who knows what has transpired in the last decade. What I did find was a thorough timeline in the Oregonian documenting the last months leading up to her death. When Trina was 3 years old, her parents divorced. By a fluke, or more likely redlining, her father would end up living on Northeast Going Street, literally a half mile from the home of Angela's murder. On May 31st, Trina was arrested near the Willamette River on Grand Avenue. She was charged with prostitution. She was 16 years old. Because of her juvenile status, she was provided a counselor through Multnomah County Juvenile Court. 6 weeks later, she confessed to the judge in court that she was actively participating in sex work, but it had been against her will. She claimed that she was being trafficked, possibly by a family member, and forced into sex work. Her sentence was probation and a referral to a program for girls who have had legal issues. No mention as to if there was an investigation surrounding the allegation against her trafficker. Because of the arrest, Trina started to spend time with a Portland Police Bureau employee who would become a stand-in big sister, which is how I'll be referring to her as the big sister. On October 22nd, Trina was taken to the hospital by her mother. She was treated for a black eye and internal bleeding, the results of a beating inflicted by her trafficker when she refused to participate in sex work. For a few months prior to this, Trina had not been on the streets because the now 17-year-old had given birth in early September. For that reason, and that she did not want to be part of it in the first place, she had told her trafficker no. By late October, Trina went missing. Attempts to contact or find her went on for days. Then, 2 weeks later, Trina was able to contact one of her resource programs and they sent a counselor to pick her up. Once safe and off the streets, she informed the counselor that she had been missing because she had been kidnapped and forced to perform sex work. Because of this, Trina was terrified that she would be found and kidnapped again. Thankfully, she had people in her life that were believing her, and they were willing to escort her everywhere she went for weeks to make sure she was staying safe. On December 6th, Trina was taking classes at Portland Community College, I would presume to get her GED, when a volatile man appeared on campus. He approached Trina and began to yell and swear at her. Other students watched on as the man grabbed Trina's arm and took her from the campus. Aware of her situation, some of the students informed the two closest Team Trina members. As for PCC's security during this incident, they made a note of it but did not find the disturbance to be that particularly important, so they did not make an official report. The next day, Trina's mother filed a missing persons report. She claimed she was being given the royal runaround. The police countered, saying that Trina's mother had not come into the station or filed a report. The next day, Alice, Trina's mother, and her PPB big sister went to the same precinct. They even reported that they went to the DA's office to file the missing persons report. That same officer said no filing was made. He would later admit a filing did happen 10 days after Alice claimed she reported Trina missing. The official report did not happen on the 13th, as that officer claimed. It had been accepted on December 9th, 3 days after Trina was kidnapped from the PCC campus. In the report, names of the kidnappers and traffickers were listed. Alice was doing everything she could to make it very clear her barely 17-year-old child, who was also a new mother, was in grave danger. When detectives started questioning people in Trina's life, her big sister shared that she had been informed by other teenagers that Trina had been spotted working in a Beaverton nightclub. It was also learned Trina was being held captive in a home on Northeast Mallory Avenue. In response to this information, which was provided to the police from a Portland Police Bureau employee, the detectives assigned to the case wrote, quote, "As far as we can determine so far in this investigation, nothing concrete has been established to place Hunter, Trina, as a captive." The next day, police began their investigation and questioned a witness who claimed to have seen Trina in the house on Mallory, but this had been back in November. That same person was a witness not just to a beating of Trina, but to demands that she prostitute herself. When Trina had made her initial escape, her trafficker reportedly said that he would beat her when he caught up to her. That same day, a detective on the case determined there was a lack of sufficient evidence or enough information to warrant a warrant. At 11:04 p.m., the court counselor received a call from Trina. Calling collect, Trina said that she needed to be picked up because she had escaped the Mallory house, but she needed help. She was cold and in fear for her life. She planned to wait outside the home of her big sister, who was not home at the time. When the police were in the area earlier that night, Trina had spotted a patrol vehicle, but she was too fearful to try to flag it down. Hanging up, the counselor called 911 and informed the dispatcher of who she was and of Trina's dire situation. She was told a car would be sent out. About half an hour later, one of the detectives working the case called that counselor to inform her of their inability to get a search warrant. When the counselor asked about the patrol car that should have, by then, either picked Trina up or been on the way to do so, the pair realized that no car had been dispatched. The detective called in to have a patrol car sent out immediately. Just 2 minutes after that second request, a patrol car was in the area looking for Trina. This was 23 minutes after that first call. When asked about the delay later on, a different detective said that the 23 minutes was not a bad response time. When it was realized that the ball was dropped, an internal investigation found there had been a shift change occurring at the time of the first call, which led to the initial request falling through the cracks. It was also later reported that that call was put lower on the list of priorities, as three armed robberies were taking place at the same time as well. All hope was not lost. About half an hour after that first call, Trina called the counselor again. Trina was in the same general area, but was closer to North Portland Catholic School. The plan was for her to wait there. The counselor would call the detective she had spoken with earlier, and he would do an urgent dispatch again. Hopefully, it would only take another 2 minutes, and Trina would be safe. But by the time the patrol car arrived, Trina was gone. It's unclear what the timeline was from dispatch to arrival. At 3:30 a.m., 4.5 hours after her first plea for help, Trina called again. The counselor reported that there was now background noise that sounded like a group of people and that Trina sounded scared and strange. Trina said, quote, "If you had just come for me, or if the big sister had been home, this would all be over now." Trina's conversation started to go in circles, with Trina asking about her grandmother, her mother, her own children, over and over again. Trina paused, said she would call the counselor the following day, paused again, then the receiver clicked. Feeling helpless, the counselor didn't even bother to report the last call. The next day, Alice, Trina's mother, called the counselor's home and spoke to her husband. Alice claimed to have received a call from a woman who reported Trina was at their home and needed to be picked up. The mom called the big sister, who set out to retrieve Trina. Arriving at the home on Northeast 13th Avenue, the big sister asked for her. She was then led to a basement where Trina was surrounded by young women and men. One of the men was trying to talk her into going home and or to bed with him. Trina couldn't speak. She was terrified. The man who had been Trina's biggest tormentor and likely trafficker then threatened the big sister. Getting up, he grabbed Trina, put her in a headlock, and forced her out of the house. 911 was called either by the big sister or possibly another woman in the home who knew that Trina was being looked for. 25 minutes later, police arrived. The report from the incident claimed the woman from the house who made the call was reporting Trina, but as a runaway. Dispatchers said the woman claimed Trina was not scared and she wasn't in an abusive situation. That same woman also reported that Trina had, on at least one occasion, gone looking for her trafficker when he left the house. Another woman in the home told police once they arrived that Trina had never mentioned wanting to go home. When Trina was taken, the big sister followed. The three walked through North Portland for several blocks, but at North Interstate Avenue, the sister lost them. Police followed up by calling motels and hotels in the area, asking about Trina and the man. For the next few days and nights, Trina's support team, friends, and family members searched the area for any sign of her. Christmas came and went. It would even be wrongfully reported, probably for a dramatic effect, that it was Christmas Eve when Trina went missing. I would even venture to say that the date of Christmas Eve was chosen to maybe help garner support for the police handling of the situation. It's Christmas Eve, you've got a teenage runaway who doesn't have heightened emotions during the holidays. It seems easier to dismiss it as the hysterics of a teenager. On December 29th, some children playing near a swamp in Battleground, Washington, made a dreadful discovery. It was the body of 17-year-old Trina Hunter. One report claims that she was discovered along the road at the 4300 block of Northeast 239th. Other reports state that she was partially submerged and face down in a pond on a farm in Battleground. An autopsy would show that Trina's cause of death was homicidal drowning. The next day, Alice, Trina's mother, identified her daughter's body and informed the big sister of the tragedy. The newspaper printed, quote, "Detectives determined that Hunter was actively engaged in prostitution in Portland. A 17-year-old child who was the victim of homicidal violence after being forced into sex work. A PPB employee reported witnessing violence against her, and they dismissed her as nothing more than a prostitute." A cousin of Trina's confirmed that she had been a trafficking victim, saying that she was never drawn to the streets, but forced into them. Similar to the big sister's story, Trina's cousin said they kept her locked up in the attic, one of those where you had to put a ladder up to get out of. They beat her, and they only let her go down to work. She tried to go to the police, but nobody ever believed her. I'm guessing Trina was either forced to occupy either the basement or attic, or she had been in the attic at the Mallory house and then put in the basement at that new location. Because of Oregon's soil and frost line, which can determine the depth of a home's foundation, basements in Portland are very uncommon. Sadly, what I could find out about Trina as a person was limited to learning her parents divorced when she was three. Trina did write a list of things I want to do, which she gave to her big sister. It read, number one, take long walks, jogging. Two, get more acquainted with my family, children, mother. Three, meet new people that can help me out, get me started in a new and better life. Number four, get out and see new and exciting things, people, buildings, art, paintings. Five, read. Six, find a job that I really like and enjoy. I get a feeling Trina's case was bundled onto the list with the other girls for the Green River Task Force because her father had lived so close to where the other victims had been found. By dismissing Trina as a prostitute, her case could easily be attached to the Green River Killer. And with so many unsolved murders happening, it was easier to have her get lost in the mix than to bring charges to the trafficker, which would only highlight Portland police's mistakes in protecting her. I say that because I cannot find her case anywhere, not on Google, newspapers, Oregonian archive, not on any Oregon or Washington cold case list, nothing about an arrest. I can't even distinguish what county I should send a records request to. I did email the Clark County Cold Case Unit about it, and my email, which was sent to the address that they use for asking for tips, was blocked. I will keep digging on this one because it just feels yucky. The last murder that was included on that list for the GRTF was that of Karen Andrea Thomas. In early December 1981, Karen Thomas was living in an apartment in the 4900 block of Northeast 7th. Because the rent was too damn high, she and her three-year-old son moved back home with her mother and stepfather in mid-December. Family members would tell police that the birth of Karen's son had led to her changing her life for the better. On December 18th, Karen left the home she shared with her family. On the 21st, they all realized none of them had seen her since then. It wasn't like Karen to be out of touch with her parents or brother, especially for several days. On Monday the 21st, when Kevin, Karen's brother, and his mother realized this, they became worried right away. Thinking of where she could have gone, Kevin decided to check on her old apartment, which seems like a great place to start. She probably had a couple more days on her lease. She went back to the apartment to continue packing or maybe grabbing forgotten items. The landlord let Kevin inside the apartment, and when he went upstairs to her bedroom, he found Karen's body sprawled across her bed. Her autopsy showed that she had died of multiple stab wounds to her chest, and she had been killed either Saturday or Sunday. A suspect was not named, at least not at that time. It wouldn't be until 1997, 16 years after her murder, that a tip would come into police. Through the tip and subsequent investigation, a man by the name of Johnny Moore became a primary suspect. At the time of the murder, he would have been 43 years old. The police had an eye on Johnny for the murder since 1997, yet he was never arrested or charged for Karen's murder, and he died of a drug overdose in 2004. Why nothing came of the investigation in 7 years remains unknown. Karen's murder still appears on Portland's cold case list, and they're seeking information surrounding her death and information about Johnny Moore. It's clearly more than likely Karen was not a victim of the Green River Killer. So if you have any information about Karen or Johnny, you can contact the Portland Police Cold Case Homicide Unit at 503-823-0400. To remain anonymous, you can provide information through Crime Stoppers at 503-823-4357. And they are offering a $2,500 reward for information that leads to an arrest. Nothing came from the Green River Task Force's investigation into those cases, at least not anything that connected their deaths to Gary Ridgway, which makes sense. For Karen, Trina, and Vicky, their deaths didn't seem to match the MO. Trina and Karen's cases even appear to have possible suspects. As for the earlier victims, I'll get to their connection in a bit. In nearly the exact same location Latonja's body had been found, 6 years later, a 9-year-old boy and two of his friends were excitedly making their way home from the last day of school. It was June 15th, 1993, and as they walked across the pedestrian bridge, they looked down to the bushes and saw what appeared to be a body. Being young boys, they of course walked down for a closer look, you know, some real stand-by-me shit. The boy said, "I saw a leg and a head. She wasn't moving." Like Essie's body, which had been concealed in the bushes, this body was partially undressed and shared the hallmark of there having been some sort of attempt to hide it. The boy ran home and reported the discovery to his dad. Probably shocked, the father and son drove back to the park. Sure enough, what his son had told him was true. There was a body in the bushes. The man went back to his car and used his mobile phone to call the police. Upon first examination, it was noted that the woman had head injuries, but it wasn't obvious if they had been the cause of her death. The body was so contorted, the first officers couldn't tell the gender, saying, quote, "Somebody who is alive can't lie like that." Investigators held on to the possibility that she, like the other women, had been murdered elsewhere, then dumped at the scene that day. The body had identification on it, which was helpful when it came to informing her family. In the paper, her name wasn't listed, but her rap sheet was, which did have prostitution listed, among other offenses. Eventually, the victim's name was released. She was 29-year-old Luana Janelle Triplett. Investigators learned the last time Luana had been seen was as she was walking on Northeast Alberta Street in North Portland at 1:30 a.m. The autopsy showed she had died due to strangulation and injuries to her abdominal cavity. Unlike the victims from 6 years prior, Luana's death was more violent. She was beaten, brutalized, and had a severe bite mark on her nipple. Thankfully, that wound had enough DNA from the attacker remaining that it could be collected by investigators. When word spread about Luana's murder, tips started rolling in. One man called and gave surprisingly helpful information. Unfortunately, he gave the name 21 and never called back after saying he would. To this day, police would like to speak with him. No arrest was made for the murder of Luana, at least not at that time. No arrest for any of the North Portland girls, Essie, Luana, Latonja, Angela, or Tanya, would happen for a very long time. Next week, I'll share the story of the accused perpetrator of these murders. I don't want to give anything away. I'll just say, I still don't know who did it.
Well, that's intriguing.
I thought so.
Meaning... I'm wondering if the person of interest might not be the one who did it, is what I'm thinking you're going to talk about.
That would probably. Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's the answer.
Okay.
It might be. I feel like it might be.
Well, hopefully it's intriguing enough for you to listen next week.
Yeah.
I'll be here.
Honestly, I can't answer because I don't know the answer. I don't know if it's the right person. I don't know that it's not the right person.
Hmm.
But there are a lot of concerning elements, from interrogation to evidence to outcome, that make you go,
The usual.
You hear that, lady at the Oregonian, who I kept emailing and won't get back to me?
I love that we've coined that the term Gmail.
Gmail
has become a... It's just what we say.
Well, yeah.
Well, you and I, at least. I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard Emily say Gmail.
I would never say that. I would say email me.
But it's fun.
And then you know where the address is.
Back in the day when I had a real or a regular job, I would sometimes be, you know, I'd have to crawl under houses for my work. And I would sometimes pop a little nap in there. A few minutes.
That's great.
It was real nice.
You're like, it's nice and toasty in this crawl space.
It's like a basement, a crawl space, all that dirt. Oh, you just put your head down, take a nap.
That is one of the weirder things you've ever told us.
It's very soothing.
It's fun to know, because I bet a lot of tech or
always. It was a way for me to just sort of disconnect from reality and go to another world for 5 minutes. Where,
please God.
Where I didn't wish I was dead under that crawl space.
Jesus Christ.
Find this stinky corpse.
Please let the earthquake come now and let this building crush my soul.
Oh my God.
We had a basement and it was scary. You've been in it, Leash.
I did. That was a great party.
Oh, so good.
I want to go to a party.
Okay, let's have
a
party.
Barbecue real bad.
You're going to a party barbecue
later.
In like an hour.
You know, not that kind.
Well, plan one. Let's have one.
Yeah.
What were you watching?
Jade. Starring David
Caruso. A classic
Caruso.
Sexual thriller.
I have never heard of it.
Right along with Fatal Attraction.
Basic Instinct.
And Disclosure.
Interesting.
And
it sounds like a video game.
Sliver.
Yeah. It's way more along the lines of Sliver than...
go ahead.
...of Northeast Goring. Those are some fun facts. We'll fix it in post.
One of the best types of bloopers. I love that. Fanta. Orange Julius.
I found a TikTok where these girls showed you how to make a Orange Julius at home.
Oh, I did that back in the day, and then I learned about curdling milk, so I was like, I'm not doing this right. But they are fun to make at home, little treats. Okay. Those are... Hello? Hello? Hello?
Puberty hit. Finally.
Oh, jeez.
My pubes are coming in.
Jeepers, guys.
Oh, shit. Wow, that was close. Sorry. I pushed a button and almost fucked everything up.
Oh,
my
cool.
God.
Don't
we
push anything
to start over
there.
Over.
It's all good.
It was thick.
Sullivan's Gulch?
Mm-hmm.
I think you said Sullivan.
What was the difference that you just said?
Sullivan's and Sullivan.
Oh. Okay.
Plurals.
Walking in the
not
park.
Not plural, ownership.
So sorry.
Yeah, ownership, you motherfucker.
Well, you
gotcha. Gotcha. I beat
gotcha,
you to it.
Stupid. You stupid. Idiot boy. You're wrong. I'm right. Ownership. Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.